The views expressed on the following program are the views of the show's host and do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station, their management, their donors, their underwriters, nor their seventh-born sons. Broadcasting from our secret underground studio in Olympia, Washington, it is time for the Thunderbolts. Yes, kids, there you were, enjoying your privileged white status, blissfully ignorant of the fact that your shoes were manufactured by a child slave, until one day you turned on your radio and you were struck by the Thunderbolt! Hello, Cascadia! It's time to wake up! Yes, you better grab that cup of coffee, because you are about to be struck by the thunderbolt of truth and justice. Here it comes. Yes, kids. The thunderbolt is your guide to activism in Thurston County. I have news. I have commentary, I have a calendar for activist-related events, kick-ass music, and dumb jokes! So Cascadia is off of the couch and into the streets! It's time to save civilization from fiery apocalypse! Though even the apocalypse is gonna have to wait until I have had a cup of coffee! Hello, hello, hello. This is the Thunderbolt for August 17th, 2018. I do have another show from the archives this week, but this is another one of those single-themed shows, in that this week's entire news and commentary section is dedicated to the Federal Reserve, and it deserves it. Let's go. We are going to start off this Thunderbolt by quoting the ex-head of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan. The Federal Reserve is an independent agency, and that means that there is no agency of government that can overrule any actions that we take. Unquote. And you know, one manner in which Americans have devolved is that for most of American history, the American public has utterly loathed, unreservedly feared, and thoroughly detested big banks. Our entire national history, from even before the beginning, in fact, can largely be defined as an often successful struggle by Americans to be free of the chains of the banksters. These days, though, Americans simply shake their heads and they think that there is nothing that they can do about it. Well, I would suggest that history says otherwise. Now, most countries have an institution that is usually known as a central bank. Now, in the United States, this central bank is known as the Federal Reserve. even though it is actually neither. And here is what a central bank does. A central bank is given the right to create money, literally, out of nothing. And then what they do is they loan all of that free money to individuals and to governments at extortionist levels of interest. Now, as you may guess, printing trillions of free dollars is a very profitable enterprise, even without the added bonus of compound interest. Now, not only does this state of affairs place a given government into the bankster's debt, but as with any unsecured loan, the bank also insists upon a major say in how that money is subsequently used. And the way that the banksters like to use that money is to foment wars. So the battle betwixt the banksters trying to enslave the American public and the public's resistance to said enslavement erupted right at the beginning and even before the beginning of the United States itself. And until World War I, our side mostly won. Now, I have not seen that play about Alexander Hamilton that has become so popular, and so I won't say anything about it, except that if, as I assume, this play attempts to make some kind of heroic figure out of that vile and scheming little thief, then I say, screw them and their play. So I could go on and on about all of the nasty crap that Alexander Hamilton pulled during his non-illustrious career. But one of the more egregious examples of Hamilton's shenanigans during that period consisted of repossessing the homes of active soldiers and throwing their families out onto the streets as the soldiers themselves were freezing the front of their backsides at Valley Forge. Because the Continental Congress was not paying anyone for anything at that time. And so the soldiers could not keep up with their house payments. However, for this piece, I am going to stick to Alexander Hamilton's prodigious efforts to form a central bank. In 1781, the United States was in very deep financial doo-doo. The paper currency they issued to pay for the war had collapsed from inflation and from British counterfeiting. Desperate to find a way to finance the end stages of their war, Congress turned to a gentleman named Robert Morris, who was, get this, America's leading war profiteer. And Mr. Morris was appointed superintendent of finance. And from 1781 to 1784, he was regarded as the most powerful man in the United States, second only to George Washington himself. Mr. Morris argued for the creation of a privately owned central bank that he deliberately modeled upon the Bank of England, one of the central institutions that the colonies were supposedly fighting against at the time. However, Congress was backed into a financial corner. Does that sound familiar? And they felt they had no choice but to do business with the banksters on their terms. And the new Bank of North America's first order of business was to loan the United States government $1.2 million. Now, fortunately, Mr. Morris had fallen out of political favor by the end of the Revolution, and the Bank of North America's currency had failed to win over a skeptical public. However, the banksters did not give up. Before the ink was even dry on the Constitution, a group led by Alexander Hamilton was already working to form the next central bank. Now, Hamilton, to his credit, made no bones about his agenda. He wanted the United States government in debt to his bankster friends. He wrote, "A national debt, if not excessive, will be to us a national blessing." Thomas Jefferson disagreed. Rather adamantly so, in fact. Mr. Jefferson, in fact, said this: "The spirit of war and indictment, since the modern theory of the perpetuation of debt has drenched the earth with blood and crushed its inhabitants under burdens ever accumulating." Hamilton won out, though. So here is James Corbett's description of what happened next. "The First Bank of the United States is chartered in 1791 and follows the pattern of the Bank of England and the Bank of North America almost exactly. It is a privately owned central bank with the authority to loan money that it creates out of nothing to the government. In fact, it is the very same people behind the new bank as were behind the old Bank of North America. Yes, it was Alexander Hamilton, who was Robert Morris's former aide, who first proposed Robert Morris for the position of financial superintendent and the director of the Bank of North America. Thomas Willing is brought in to serve as the first director of the First Bank of the United States. Yes, meet the new banking bosses. The same as the old banking bosses. However, when the bank's charter comes due for renewal in 1811, the tide has changed for the moneyed interests behind the bank. Alexander Hamilton is dead. The bank supporting the Federalist Party is out of power. The public is wary of foreign ownership of the central bank. And what's more, do not see the point of a central bank in a time of peace. And accordingly, the charter renewal is voted down in the Senate, and the bank is closed in 1811. However, a year later, the United States was once again at war with England for reasons that were not entirely unconnected to this battle of the bank. And the United States once again found itself in need of funny money from thin air. With trade at a standstill, prices soaring, inflation rising, and debt mounting, in 1816, President James Madison signed the charter for the creation of another central bank, the Second Bank of the United States. Just as with the two previous central banks, this one was privately owned, and it was granted the power to loan money that it created out of thin air to the government. So this 20-year bank charter was due to expire in 1836, and President Andrew Jackson, long before that, vowed he was going to let it die. But believing that Jackson would not risk his chance for re-election in 1832 over this issue, the banksters forwarded a bill to renew the bank's charter in July of that year, which was 4 years ahead of schedule. But remarkably, Jackson vetoed this renewal charter, and he staked his entire re-election upon the people's support of his move, which they did indeed subsequently do. Andrew Jackson was re-elected with the slogan, Jackson and No Bank. In 1833, Jackson announced that the government would stop using the bank and would pay off its debt. The banksters retaliated in 1834 by staging a financial crisis and attempted to pin the blame on Jackson. But it was all of no use. On January 8, 1835, Andrew Jackson succeeded in paying off the debt of the United States. And for the first and only time in its history,
the United States was free from the debt chain of the banksters. In 1836, the Second Bank of the United States' charter expired and the bank lost its status as America's central bank. And it was 77 years before the banksters could regain this jewel in their crown. Though it was not for a lack of trying. So I will now describe for you a typical economic cycle. The banksters hand out low-interest loans like pancakes at a Sunday breakfast, and thus they kickstart the economy into high gear. Then, at a certain point, they sell all of their own stocks, they call in all of their loans, and thus they intentionally collapse the economy. They sit on a ton of cash as everyone else panics, and then they eventually start buying back everything that they just sold at a fraction of the cost that they just sold it for. And then they start the process all over again. And they usually begin the new economic buildup by starting a war. Throughout the late 19th century, the United States was rocked by banking panics brought about by wild banking speculation and then sharp contractions in credit. By the dawn of the 20th century, the bulk of the money in the American economy had been centralized into the hands of a small clique of industrial magnates, each with a near monopoly on their sector of the economy. Yes, there were Astors in real estate, the Carnegies and the Schwabs in steel, the Harrimans, Stanfords, and Vanderbilts in railroads, the Mellons, and the Rockefellers in oil. And as all of these families started to consolidate their fortunes, they gravitated naturally to the banking sector. And in this capacity, they formed a network of financial interests and institutions that centered largely around one man, the banking scion, and increasingly America's informal central banker in the absence of a central bank, John Pierpont Morgan. Yes, it was Morgan that financed the launch of nearly every major corporation of the period, from AT&T to General Electric to General Motors to DuPont. It was Morgan who financed Cornelius Vanderbilt's New York Central Railroad. It was Morgan who bought out Carnegie and the United States Steel Corporation. It was was Morgan who brokered a deal with President Grover Cleveland to save the nation's gold reserves by selling $62 billion worth of gold to the Treasury in return for government bonds. And it was Morgan who, in 1907, set in motion the crisis that led to the creation of the Federal Reserve. And then, according to the newspapers, Morgan mounted his white steed and rode to the rescue. And somehow they failed to mention that he was rescuing us from a crisis that he had himself created. In some circles, that is known as a protection racket. Yes, J.P. Morgan single-handedly manufactured the panic of 1907 and the resultant investigation found that three banking interests, J.P. Morgan, National Citibank, and the Citibank of New York, controlled the entire financial system.
The congressional report that resulted from that panic ignited public hatred toward the banksters, and there was an overwhelming consensus in the country to establish a central bank in order to curb them. And we will learn how that turned out after a short break. The views expressed on the Thunderbolt are my views, and no one else's. Those views do not necessarily reflect the views of any of the stations that air the Thunderbolt, nor anybody that has anything to do with any of those stations. And now, back to the Thunderbolt. And so, in part one of the non-federal unreserved, we covered the original formation of the Federal Reserve Bank. Now, there were many very different interests pushing for the Federal Reserve, and these various interests had their own purpose behind advocating for it, including the J.P. Morgan factions, the progressives of the time viewed a central bank as a tool to marginalize the power of the New York banksters. And they assumed that this central bank would be 100% controlled by the public through some sort of government agency. The banksters, on the other hand, saw a privately owned central bank, owned by them, of course. And this bank would serve as yet another tool to control and manipulate everything and everyone. They envisioned an entity that would be owned and that would serve the interests of their own interests. Now, the main individual behind the founding of the Federal Reserve was Paul Warburg, who was a partner with Kuhn, Loeb & Company.
which was an European banking house. In 1910, Warburg got the support of a senator named Nelson Aldrich, whose family later married into the Rockefeller family. So Aldrich invited Warburg and a number of other bankers to a private and super secret meeting on a place called Jekyll Island, just off the coast of Georgia. And they met there to discuss the construction of a central bank in the United States. All of the ringleaders of the great bankster conspiracy were in attendance. They had gone to extraordinary lengths to keep this meeting secret. They had been told to arrive one by one after sunset in order to attract as little attention as possible. Secrecy was so important to their mission that the group did not use anything but their first names throughout their journeys so as to keep their true identities secret, even from their own servants and wait staff. The movements of any one of them would have been reason enough to attract the attention of New York's voracious press, especially in an era where banking and monetary reform was seen as a key issue for the future of the nation. A meeting of all these men would surely have been the story of the century. And indeed, it was. As one participant put it, the discovery of our plan, we knew, simply must not happen, or else all of our time and effort would be wasted. If it were to be exposed publicly that our particular group had gotten together and written a banking bill, that bill would have had no chance whatever of passage by Congress. I couldn't have said it better myself. Basically, the attendees at the Jekyll Island meeting wrote the legislation for what became known as the Federal Reserve Act. Meaning that the criminals wrote their own laws in order to, quote, reform, unquote, their own banks. Thus, in the end, the people who caused the panic of 1907 used the public's own outrage over the panic against them in order to complete their complete takeover of the American banking system. And the newly retitled Federal Reserve Act was signed into law on December 23rd, 1913. Merry Christmas. The Federal Reserve Act not only allowed the banksters to regulate themselves, but it gave them something they hadn't dared to dream they could ever get from an American Congress. That was complete control over the money supply. Yes, kids, the same banksters who had just looted the entire country were given complete and total cartel control of America's money itself. And for purposes of marketing this scam to the public, it was labeled as the Federal Reserve, even though there was virtually nothing federal about it. And soon thereafter, there were not even any reserves. People were led, and are still led, to believe that the Federal Reserve is some sort of federal agency that is under some sort of federal control, when it is not, nor has it ever been, either. The Federal Reserve was sold to the public as banking reform. And the public largely believed this crap, just like they always do. And here is how the scam works. The common myth that the banksters try to inculcate is that the economy is a massive, highly complex machine that goes wherever it will go, and that no one can really understand it or control it. They often refer to the invisible hand of the market. Well, every part of that statement is the complete opposite of the truth. Economic basics are nothing more than simple math. And virtually everything that happens in the, quote, free market is completely controlled by a small handful of individuals. And as I said, the Federal Reserve literally creates money out of nothing and then lends it to the government and to individuals at interest. Since this is insane, then occasionally one or another of the Federal Reserve banks will create a cartoon-written, dumbed-down video attempting to explain the Federal Reserve to us rubes in a manner that we might accept. And here is a quote from one of those brochures put out in 1977 by the New York Fed. Commercial banks create checkbook money whenever they grant a loan simply by adding new deposit dollars to accounts on their banks in exchange for a borrower's IOU. And there you have it. This is the secret to their alchemy. They literally create money out of nothing. If a borrower signs an IOU, the bank simply creates that money on their computer, and then they put this magic money onto their books. There are no dollar bills, nor checks, nor anything else. Numbers simply appear on a spreadsheet, and suddenly a bunch of money appears out of nowhere in the form of a debt that is now owed back to the very bank that created it in the first place. At interest. And here is another very important part of this scam that you need to understand. Fractional reserve banking. Now, the practice of banking originally came about when people started to bring their gold or silver to a trusted person for safekeeping. They would say, "Protect our gold and silver so people will not come in the middle of the night and steal it. And you can simply give us a paper receipt so later we can bring our receipt back and retrieve our gold." Thus, in the beginning, money was nothing more than a receipt. Instead of changing or exchanging gold coins, they could exchange receipts instead. But the banks quickly figured out that on the average, maybe 5-7% of the people would actually bring their paper receipts in and ask for the gold. And so banksters figured out that they could get away with handing out more receipts than they actually held in gold, and that no one would ever even know it. Plus, They could not only create receipts for gold that they did not actually have, but they could even loan that money out and collect interest, meaning that they were charging interest on money that they didn't really have. And this practice is called fractional banking. Even though the practice is deceptive and dishonest, it has long been institutionalized and is now taught in schools. No one even longer even questions the integrity or the ethics of the practice. They simply assume that this is simply the way that it works. Of course, the problems arise whenever conditions, such as an economic downturn, will cause a large percentage of the people to bring their paper in and demand their gold, because the banksters are forced to then admit that actually there isn't any gold and that their paper substitute is actually quite worthless. So the Federal Reserve System was allegedly created to put a stop to all that. But since the people who designed this plan to put a stop to such practices were also the very ones who were engaging in those very practices in the first place, no one should be surprised that their solution further benefited themselves rather than the American people. And so, we ended up with an institution that is private, that wields immense public power, and that has virtually no public accountability. The Federal Reserve has never even been audited by Congress. So, immense power wielded by psychopaths who have no accountability? What could go wrong?
It's time to get to work now. Right. So that is it for the news and commentary section this week. For Seattle listeners, I will not only fill out the rest of the hour with some music for you, but believe it or not, I'm going to fill it with ukulele music. And if you are not already familiar with Jake Shimabukuro, then you should be, and you're about to be. So enjoy.
Thank you.
Right. That was Let's Dance. Before that, we had Time After Time. Before that was the Bohemian Rhapsody. And we started that set off with In My Life. And all of that was featuring Jake Shimabukuro. And that's it for the Thunderbolt this week. So I'll see you next week. The Thunderbolt is a production of Dancing Angel Media, which is solely responsible for the content. Neither the stations that air the Thunderbolt, their sponsors, their members, their underwriters, nor anyone else that has much to do with anything else in any way, is responsible for the content of the Thunderbolt. Nor do they necessarily agree with the views expressed on the Thunderbolt. If you have any comments, or if you wish to express an opposing opinion, you should send an email to dana98501@gmail.com. And we will make arrangements. And I hope that you have a day. And a quick note here. The Thunderbolt is on Facebook, where you can find links to the show and to the show notes. Or you can go to radioforall.net. That's radio4all.net, where you can also find the show notes, as well as a year's worth of downloadable episodes of the Thunderbolt. Thank you very much.